Hey guys, welcome back to the Love That Lasts podcast. This is Jeff, and we really hope that you're enjoying the show as much as we enjoy creating it. And this week, the Anatomy of Marriage miniseries is back, and we think you guys are going to really dig this episode, so sit back and enjoy.
Our show is supported by the Love That Lasts experience. This experience is a new approach to helping couples tackle the tough questions in marriage. The Love That Lasts experience includes two separate guidebooks, 12 video lessons by marriage mentors on 12 big marriage topics. The experience also includes the Deep Love Assessment, and it also has a private Facebook group created just for this community, and the brand new Love That Lasts book by us. To learn more about this amazing marriage resource, visit lovethatlasts.co. Lovethatlasts.co.
Today, we're talking all about talking. Sort of. This episode is all about communication. And I'm going to let Dr. Les and Leslie Parrott get us started.
So communication is the lifeblood of a relationship. You can gauge the tenor, the warmth, the intimacy, the connection, the friendship, whatever you want to call it in a relationship based on how well they're communicating. If people aren't communicating well, the relationship is not going well. So it's the lifeblood. Mm-hmm.
And words convey so much, you know, and actually even not words, but subtle things. Like if we roll our eyes at each other, that's powerful. And sarcasm, you know, can be a sign of contempt, actually. But this is where our families really do shape us. Sarcasm might be a sign of playful connection and attachment for another person. Yeah. And so that's where you have to become aware, you know, I know what your motives are and I know how it hits me. Let's find our way through this, because awareness is really curative in those moments. So you don't take it to heart in the same way if you realize, wow, your family does playful teasing and it's all about who can, you know, give the best zinger, and that means I love you the most, yeah. You know, versus that's wounding and no one who loves me would ever speak to me that way.
So when it comes to communication, so many people get hung up on trying to get the skills of communication right. When you begin to take communication and apply rules to how it's done, it can really cause some friction for couples. I'm not against those rules. We all need that sense.
So Seth and I sat down with our producer, Matt, and his little baby to share some stories about our terrible communication.
We would have a lot of arguments. Do you remember that?
Do you know? I've been wanting to share this, actually. On our honeymoon, Seth said we should get a divorce.
In Maui.
And he wasn't kidding.
Yeah, I've heard that story before. And I've heard it from other people. Like, that's actually relatively
common. Mean other couples?
I've heard of other couples had that kind
for a minute,
of thing
I thought
worse
you meant,
on their honeymoon.
I thought you meant other people told you our story. And I'm like, what?
Who in the world? I remember you splashed me in the face in the pool.
Yeah,
is that like ridiculous?
Is that what Les was saying there? Like sarcasm, maybe to you, you thought it was an okay thing or a good thing or a playful thing. And to her, she thought it was assault.
No, it was the opposite. Mm-hmm. I always thought, so in our family, sarcasm is like our primary language. Mm-hmm. Everything is like, nice job. Everything is like that. And right. So when I would be sarcastic to him, he would get really upset with me. And then it would just be a fight.
But like, was the splashing thing, for instance, you took him splashing you, he meant it playfully and you took it as it.
Well, what he did was I was swimming away from him and he grabbed my foot and pulled me. So I went under and choked. Yeah. And so to me, that felt.
And then you splashed me. And I was like, really? I was like, what the hell? And
yeah,
then,
you were like, mad at me.
Because I left the pool. Yeah, so
and
like,
they wanted to get a divorce.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yes.
So right away, this conversation doesn't even feel like it's about communication, right? That's because communication is like a knot in really, really long hair. At some level, you understand that it is just a bunch of twisted up individual strands of hair, but at the exact same time, you're looking at a hot mess of hair and can't tell one piece from the other because they're so mixed up. That is communication. It is tied to our family of origin, it is tied to our level of understanding and education, it's tied to our experiences and our identity. I mean, it's just plain old tied to everything. And when Seth and I started dating, we miscommunicated like 99% of the time. And that's partially due to the fact that our dating relationship was very atypical. I know you already know this, but when we were dating, Seth was in a band and was touring the country with a bunch of dudes in a van while I was back in Washington finishing up college. And every time I try to talk to Seth about this stuff, he brings up all of these clinical things that to me feel like, yeah, whatever, sure, those matter a little bit, but there's gotta be something more to the idea that we were very seldom together, and then when we were together, I was competing with his 6 best friends for his attention, and we were never alone. Like I said, very atypical. But we weren't the only ones dating while in a band. In fact, we were surrounded by couples who were a lot like us, living crazy lives apart, or even crazier lives together on the road.
I crawl up to the front of the van.
Meet Christy and Matt McDonald.
I was like, what are you going to do? I'm driving, like, what are you going to do?
They are the beautiful voices behind the band Vocal Few. Matt also happens to be the frontman of the band The Classic Crime.
When we got married was right before my band signed to Tooth & Nail Records. And so like 2 months after we were married, we're finally able to live together and, you know, start a life together. I went to record in the studio for like 7 weeks. So I was gone. She was still getting her immigration stuff sorted, so she couldn't work.
Christy is Canadian.
And so it was a big dynamic shift for her. When we got back from the studio, we started making plans to tour pretty intensively all of 2006. We just decided since she couldn't work and she didn't really have much going on that she would just come with us on the road. And she, you know, we would have her do sort of tour manager responsibilities or, you know, run merch and stuff like that.
Life on the road is really weird. I only went on tour with Seth's band Emery like one or two times, and while it was super fun, it wasn't exactly my favorite way to live. Typically, there's like eight of you crammed into a crappy van or a converted old school bus. You can't really shower anywhere. You eat junk food. You stay up all hours of the night loading and unloading gear. It's sweaty, stinky, and just crazy.
Being on the road with guys in a band is kind of like a marriage in a way. Like everyone's in close proximity. We have to live together and we have to compromise and we have to overcome struggle and adversity together, and then you throw an actual marriage in the mix, it becomes really difficult to, you know, to get alone time, to overcome those little things. You know, I found myself being the go-between for my band, like, hey, can you tell Christy to do this and this with the merch, or can she go do this? And then Christy would come to me and say, hey, can you tell your bandmates to like lay off me because blah blah blah.
Well, and then the band would come to me and be like, Matt's being an asshole right now. Can you tell him to blah, blah, blah? I'm like, you guys, it was like this twisted communication.
Yeah, like, but because of that situation, we fought a lot. And Christy and I would get in fights about anything and everything just because of the tension and the pressure of being, you know, we slept in the van with the band. Like, we had no alone time. Like,
yeah, this was in the good old days.
In the beginning, we like had a futon in the back and we would line up like sardines. I would have Christy on one side of me and my bandmates on the other. I guess fast forward about 6 months into our first year of touring, it all comes to a head, of course, on Warped Tour.
Enter Warped Tour.
On this particular tour, The Classic Crime decides to tour in a van instead of a tour bus, which means that they will not have a driver for the long overnight drives that are required when you're touring festivals. And so one of the actual band members has to drive hundreds of miles at night and lose an entire night's sleep to get to the next venue. One evening, Matt was the driver, and just before heading out, he had to pick up Christy from a mustache party that she and an acquaintance were hanging out at.
So it was my night to drive. I drive over in front, and I park the van, and I run it, and I see Christy. I'm like, I'm parked out front. I have to drive all night. Can you come out? Of course, she takes like 15, 20 minutes. And I sent another band member to go in and get her. And finally, when she got back into the van, I was just fuming mad. Like, how could you, number one, like, totally disrespect me? Because I have to sleep at some point. And we've been on this tour for a couple weeks now. None of us have really slept, or we're all just like aggravated. And then number two, you're hanging out with this annoying girl that is like seemingly influencing you to do stupid things and maybe like not carry your weight with the group or whatever.
Matt and Christy begin to argue, but remember, they live in a van with a bunch of other guys. And if they want to sort things out at all, they have to do it with an audience.
So I'm driving and I'm just like, I can't believe you guys. And, you know, Christy's a little lippy or whatever. And I'm like, you guys are just acting like total b****es. And like Christy flips out.
I crawl up to the front of the van.
I was like, what are you gonna do? I'm driving, like, what are you gonna do?
He's just taunting me. And I crawled up to the front of the van and I just straight bit him in the arm.
She's biting me in the arm. I was like, that doesn't hurt. That doesn't hurt. That doesn't hurt.
And he kept saying it didn't hurt. So like a 5-year-old kid, I just kept biting harder.
Until she drew blood. And then my bandmates are all like screaming, like, pull over, don't kill everybody. Leave the van and like go deal with it. So I pull over, I get outside of I walk around to the side door of the van and I open it up. And like Christy's like holding onto the seat. She's like, no, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to talk to you. And I'm like, I start pulling on her arm to get her out of the van. She's like, help, help. And then like Robbie,
his poor bandmates. I'm like,
Robbie comes out of, like, Robbie can't see anything. He's in the back of the van. He comes out the back door and comes around. He's like, don't you touch her. Like, he's going to, like, he thinks I'm going to, like, abuse her or something. And really, I was just trying to get her out of the van so we could have a conversation. So he comes around. He comes at me. So I just focused, like, all my rage at my guitar player. And I, like, picked him up and, like, slammed him on the ground and, like, headbutted him in the head. And then we see lights flash and we see a police officer. I pull him right up and, like, we just arms around each other, like, yeah, what's up? Yeah, we're buddies. We're just hanging out. You
know? I'm hanging out there. I still have my Hitler stash on from the mustache party. So,
they let us go. We pulled over. And Christy, like, crawls in the back and is just, like, sobbing. But the next day, we sorted it, obviously. Everyone, you know, heads cooled down. Christy and I sorted it. And it was just like, man, that cannot happen. And here's how I was hurt. And she's like, here's how I was hurt. And we apologize. And everything's fine. And then we have to sit down with the entire band and just listen to each single one of them criticize and say how terrible our marriage is and how terrible we are as people. And, like, listen to all of that. Because we had these fights in front of other people, it forced us to really deal with the repercussions of it, as opposed to having a fight alone and then just going on about your day and not really
letting it pass by. We didn't have the chance to do that.
Steering blind in every accident I've caused, there's no survivors. I hope my passengers forgive me my mistakes. We haven't made it to our destination yet, we still have debts to pay. But remember when we used to believe.
We're going to talk more about communication right after a quick word from our sponsors.
Hey everyone, we want to just take a minute to thank a few of the sponsors who made this show possible, and that's Compassion International. Basically, me and Alyssa, what we're trying to do is get kids sponsored across the globe through Compassion International. And if you know them, they're incredible, they're amazing, they do everything from help with medical to schooling to food to shelter and on and on and on. And the best part is they also tell these kids about Jesus. We sponsor two kids. One is even on Kinsley's birthday. So if you go to compassion.com/Jeff and Alyssa and you sign up through that page and you join us in this kind of like online family of sponsoring hundreds of kids and showing our generosity, we're going to send you guys a signed copy of Love That Lasts. So compassion.com/Jeff and Alyssa, and you can get a free signed copy of Love That Lasts as a thank you. All right, back to the show.
So I'm going to be totally upfront with y'all and tell you that this episode has been really hard to make for two very different reasons. Reason number one is that communication is so wrapped into everything that we do, and that makes it super difficult to isolate without feeling like you have to backtrack and explain the thing right before the thing you just explained. Know what I mean? And secondly, because it feels so utterly convicting to me. I mean, I'm realizing things about the way that I communicate that I have never, ever, ever, ever thought about before. And they're terrible things. They are simply just terrible things. And so for this next part of the show, I thought it would be helpful to just talk about the different ways that we communicate. And y'all, it's crazy. So there are two primary ways to communicate with other people. The first is verbal communication, which was the first thing I thought about for this episode. So the way we talk to one another, right? The second communication style is nonverbal communication, which is essentially the real way that we talk to people. Let me explain what I mean. Let's start with verbal communication. When I was researching the different ways that people verbally communicate, I came up with a list of a few things like our vocabulary, or more specifically, the words that we choose to use when we speak to someone. And this may seem trivial at first, but let's just do a little role play, okay? I'm going to ask a question two different ways, and you tell me which one you like better. Ready? Hey, sweetheart. Can you please take out the trash? It's starting to smell bad. Or, Hey, fart face, the garbage smells as bad as your armpits. Why haven't you taken it out yet? See what I mean? And then there's this little thing called paralanguage, which refers to the stuff like how quickly we talk to someone. What words do we emphasize? Does our vocal tone go up or does it go down? Do we hesitate when we speak? Do we mumble? Those kinds of things. Now let's look at nonverbal communication. We'll start with body language. When Seth tells me about his day and how he was worried because one of his coworkers was really sick, do I stand there with my arms crossed like a mega bee with a scowl on my face? Or do I mirror his body language by having my own body language that shows him that I have compassion for both his concern and his coworker? What would that look like, you ask? Well, things like eye contact, facial expressions, body orientation. Am I turning away from him when he speaks to me, or am I being an active listener in the conversation and showing him that it matters to me? Now onto the trickier parts of communication, the stuff that I can't really categorize very well, so I just made up my own categories. The first one is the biopsychosocial spiritual model of communication, which would include things like family of origin, right? So like Dr. Les and Leslie Parrott were saying earlier, in one family, sarcasm might be the primary way in which different family members show love and affection, while in another family, it might be the ultimate form of insult. This is Seth and I to a T. Under that biopsychosocial spiritual communication model, there is also gender norms. So in North American society, men and women are actually taught through our culture to speak and communicate in different ways. And this is reflected in the way we communicate throughout our entire lives. It is deeply ingrained in us from birth and very, very, very hard to change. An example of this is the way that I have had to learn to be intentionally curt or brief with the men that I work with in the audio engineering world. And it actually feels wrong to me to speak to these men this way, but I know intellectually that it will yield better results. It's a total head trip. The next part gets a little wacky, but there's nothing I can do about it. So the next idea is the motivation behind our communication. So are we listening to our spouse in hopes of learning more information that we will then turn around and help solve a problem with? Or are we listening to find the next flaw in our spouse's argument that we can use as a weapon against them? Or maybe, put it in a simpler way, are we communicating to solve a problem or are we communicating to win a fight? There's also the messy business of communication through dysfunction, which might have a technical name, but I certainly don't know it. And y'all, this one hits me really close because this is probably the primary way in which I communicate to Seth. And it looks like this. I complain about something because if I complain, I know Seth will talk to me about it. Or I disapprove of his plans. I might not even care what his plans actually are, but if I disapprove of them, we can talk. There are like a million ways that people do this. Another example includes pretending to be sick all the time to get attention. And these are just ways to connect with other people that for some reason or another might feel safer to you. It is much easier for me to complain about the way that Seth stacks the firewood than it is for me to compliment him on being a kind father. So I just choose the path of least resistance, and disapproval it is. Or to put it this way, I can't tell you what's good about it, but I can tell you what's bad about it. Then there is open and closed communication. Things like, are you actually willing to learn something new when you communicate with your spouse? Would you even be open to the idea that you might not know every single thing on the entire planet ever? Do you find new information helpful and inspiring, or does it make you feel angry and defensive? Like, if you actually learn something new from your spouse, are you so closed off that you would defend the incorrect thing no matter what? I'm just asking. There's also direct and indirect communication. An example of direct communication is something like, hey Seth, I want you to clean these floors today, versus, how come I'm the only one who ever cleans these floors? See the difference there? One is directly saying, I want you to do this thing, while the other one is indirectly saying that I want you to do this thing, but I don't want to tell you that I want you to do this thing. It's sort of like being passive aggressive. And while all of this information is really lovely, as humans, we tend to just go to what we know. And way down deep at the core of communication is connection. But unfortunately, we're taught our communication skills in a very biased setting, which essentially means that we never choose our communication style. We just go to what we know. I'm sarcastic because my family has always been sarcastic. And in my particular family circle, that is all fine and dandy. But when you add in a husband who thinks sarcasm is the work of Satan, things get a little twisted. But enough out of me. Here is Dr. Dan Siegel. You'll recognize him from other episodes. Here he is answering an urgent question that I have about communication.
I am the type of person where I'm like, no, the way that I'm going to do this makes a lot more sense than the way my husband's going to do it, right? So how do I honor and respect that because I have a really hard time with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, everyone does. In development, between 3 and 9, kids develop something called metacognition, which is thinking about thinking. One of the metacognitive skills that are hard for any of us to develop is called representational diversity. And what that means is a representation would be like a thought or a plan or, you know, an approach or whatever. That's the representation. Diversity means you've got one and your husband has another. So part of it is this breathing into that metacognitive skill where you say, look, how old are your kids, Melanie? How old are
they? 8, 7, and 4.
8, 7, and 4. Okay. So you have an 8, 7, 4. You say the 8-year-old, you know, signed up for camp, doesn't want to go. And your husband says, that's fine. He doesn't want to go to camp. That's fine. I didn't go to camp when I was a kid. It's fine. You go, no. If he signed up for it, he has to stick to it. Now, you can just say you're wrong. He's got to go to camp. I'm the mom, and I don't really value this. You're at work, blah, 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 whatever. Or you can say, okay, I'd like to hear your point of view so I can understand you're suggesting he drop out of camp. I have a different point of view, but I really want to understand your point of view. So he says, all right, here's my reasoning. He should be able to drop out of camp because X, Y, and Z. And you go, okay, tell me more about X, tell me more about Y, tell me more about Z. And you are genuinely interested in what he's saying. You're not just saying it to say it. And then he, in turn, would say, okay, so tell me what your point of view is. Well, I think he should stay in camp. Why? Well, because of A, B, and C. Or tell me more about A, tell me more about B, tell me more about C. Okay, then you share the discussion. Okay, I see X and I see Y. I don't really understand Z. Tell me more about that. Oh, okay. And then he says to you, yeah, I get A, B, and C. And I can see your point of view. I can see why you'd want him to go to camp. What are our values together as a co-parenting team? You know, well, our value is to teach him to have perseverance and grit. And, you know, we read this book on grit and we want him to realize that he should stick to it. Yes, but don't you know we should really be sensitive to his needs? And he's saying he doesn't want to go. And, you know, shouldn't we be tuning in? Doesn't Dan Siegel say attunement is everything? Well, actually, it's not what I say. But attunement is important, but it's not everything. So then you come to some mutual agreement. I see our parenting goal is to teach him grit, to teach him to that people around him know what he's into, but we believe he can do it. And so we say, you make a collective decision, he's going to stay in camp. But even if that was the decision you wanted in the first place, you show genuine interest and respect for your husband's point of view. Together, you weighed the pros and cons. And together, you came to a mutual co-parenting decision. He isn't just going along with you. You together said that's probably best for our overall goal for our son's development.
I love it.
You can do that.
I hope I can
do that. That's very different than saying, I'm right, you're wrong. I'm not really interested in what you have to say.
Seth and I sat down with our producer, Madagascar, and talked about this stuff. His name's just Matt. And then the first thing he said was this.
Yeah, well, you know, if think about it extended to personality disorders.
Great.
So if you take something where the way that you think you are coming across or the way that something you think about yourself isn't true, but you believe it's true, you know, you see that on the end of narcissism or some other sociopathy or something where it's untethered from the reality anyway. Mm-hmm. And so all of us have that to some degree. Mm-hmm. So you can see how a relatively balanced person still thinks they're totally right and doesn't even have the ability to see that they are wrong mm-hmm. or how that comes across.
Yeah.
So there's these, and I don't know if any of the people we interviewed talk about this, but the concept of I statements.
No, I don't think any of them did.
Okay.
I know they didn't, actually. Sorry.
I wish I had.
Instead of saying to somebody, you do this or you do this and this makes me whatever, you just say, I feel this way about this situation.
Yeah, it
prevents defensiveness.
What if I just turned it into this? I feel like you did this bad thing.
No, that's not the way to do it. You would say, you know, what you said to me just now made me feel XYZ. When I feel that way, I think this is in jeopardy. And when I think this is in jeopardy, then I'm going to fight or flight and then, you know, retreat to whatever.
Okay, let's set up a scenario because one is going to say jeopardy. Yeah. Let's say
nobody has the, I mean, you just be more real and specific.
Yeah.
And say that
so let's okay, say, sure. Let's make up a scenario. Matt, you make up the scenario.
Okay, let me tell you, I'll give you one that's happened to me yesterday, 2 days ago. Good I was point. Putting recess lighting in our house, crawling around in the attic on my belly and insulation. We have a new baby at home. Our house is a little crazy, trying to get under control. My wife is off work, and we have the two kids, and I'm working as much as I can. And then on the weekends, I do whatever I can. That's the days I work on the house. And crawling in and out of the attic at 5 o'clock in the middle of my project, my wife says to me, "We don't have any plans for supper. We don't have any food for supper." And I said, "Oh, well, don't worry about me. I just ate a piece of pork out of the fridge. I'll be fine," which made her very angry. I thought she meant, I expect her to be, "Thank you for all the work you're doing, all the stuff you're doing. Mm-hmm. I don't have any supper prepared for you, and I feel bad." That's what I thought she was saying, or what she at least should have been saying from my point of view.
Right.
And she was upset that we didn't have plans together as a family, or that I wouldn't help take care of supper, or what did I want
to
do?
Cook.
Yeah, I don't know. Right. Yeah, but she, yeah. And so she thought my response was horrible. And she thought my response was selfish, that it was about that versus what should we do as a family for supper.
Okay, so tell me how that whole scenario, entire scenario would be if you came down out of the attic, you know, 5 o'clock around supper time or whatever, and Bridget said to you, "Hey, Matt, I would like to eat together with you tonight. What would you like to do?" How would the whole thing go?
Right. I think that would have solved everything. There's a chance I would have said, "I can't eat supper. I got to do this work or whatever.
I'm right. in the middle of a and project." You might have an argument might come out of that because she would be feeling disappointed or neglected or need some help with the kids or whatever. And you'd be focused on, you know, the project the whole time. The point of I statements is reflecting everything back on yourself, not projecting anything. Right. Like, because what did Bridget project in that? She wanted time with you. She wanted maybe a respite or help from the kids, right? And supper. She was hungry, right? And probably tired, right?
Right.
So she had four things. That's right. She had four things going on, and of course, when we have a bunch of stuff going on, it's really hard to be articulate and as like nice and polite as we want. But just if you could think of, "Hey Matt, I would like to spend time with you tonight." And of course, this nobody speaks this way, but like, "Hey, let's me and you hang out tonight. You know, when do you think you'll be done?" "Oh, 6 o'clock. Give me an hour because I really want to hang out."
Yeah.
You know,
she lodged it as a complaint.
Exactly.
You know, which I didn't even interpret correctly in the first, anyway.
It's almost like we have certain feelings, and it's really easy to like pick up those feelings and throw them on somebody.
Yes.
You know, so she volleyed.
Right.
She volleyed. Oh, okay. If Matt, I'm gonna make this person responsible.
Yeah.
If he or she doesn't come back with what I want, there's gonna be trouble, right?
Yeah. Well, it's just you want the other person to feel the way you feel, so then they can solve it.
Right.
So I'm gonna dump my feelings and emotions onto you, which will cause you to feel these negative things that I'm feeling. Those four things. She wanted me to feel them. Thus, maybe we could solve it together. May have even been her mindset, but I would take that as an offense. Like she's trying to put things on me to make me feel bad when she shouldn't. She should be making me feel good because I'm doing good.
So the three of us came up with an example of how we can use I statements when we're faced with conflict, but we kind of had a hard time with it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of
all you gotta,
just go with the thing.
Or how about like
laundry example?
Oh yeah, there you go. Why do you always set your shoes under the bed? They don't go there. The shoes go out there and you always set them under the bed. Why can't you just do this one thing?
Okay, so when you say that, it makes me feel like I'm a little kid. Right? It makes me kind of go back to when I was, you know, 6 years old, just getting barked at by my dad and grandma. Okay.
And so what would be a typical response to that?
Okay. So I may say, "What are you talking about? I don't always leave my shoes there. Plus I just got home from working all day. I'm not really thinking about my shoes." Right. I thought it's fine.
Which
there,
is totally defensiveness. And you're right. It is like a 6 year old.
Right. Okay.
So this is how we should do it. How I should do it. So I don't like it when there's shoes in the hallway or under the bed because I kick them when I make the bed. So can I ask you to put your shoes in a different spot because I like it more?
No. I feel like you are an idiot.
That's how I feel like all my I statements
are
going
to sound. That's just immature, you know.
I feel like you can't clean the house.
I feel like I'm awesome and you're really not awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't like this feeling. No, you would say when you leave your shoes there and I have to clean them and I trip over them when I'm like trying to run because Hattie needs a towel because she spilled milk all over the place and I trip over your shoes and there's mud on the floor from where you walk through, it makes me, and I have to clean it, it really makes me feel like you don't appreciate me. And what I want from that is to feel appreciated. I want to feel like my work all day around the house or otherwise is worthwhile. And I want to be valued in that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I would like from you. Okay, so like even the act of like explaining yourself and taking total control and having complete awareness of your feelings in that, what does it set me up to do?
Yeah, it's very hard to respond to that by yelling at you defensively.
It sets up you to have empathy.
And what else?
To do the thing.
Yeah. And so what would be, so it's increasing your chances of getting a good response. Because first of all, it's not going to trigger that defensiveness thing where you're going to be defensive just because you feel attacked.
Right.
So now you don't feel attacked by what she said. Plus, she's made an appeal to have sympathy for the way that she feels. So now you could still choose to say, I don't care if that makes you feel that way. It makes your argument of I was busy at work all day and I'm tired seem a lot sillier.
Yeah.
And so you're less likely to make that, and you're more likely to see that, and you're not going to feel attacked, so you're not going to be defensive. So you're at least more likely to give real consideration to her thing and understand how you behaving differently will help her.
So you all know that in making this podcast, Seth and I recorded ourselves having conversations as well as arguments. And let me tell you something. Nothing shines a light on communication abilities or lack thereof like recording an argument. I mean, just listen to this.
All these things. And when I realized it, I was like, okay, I need to be different. I need to be better. So for 12 years, I've been working on all of those things and I'm very different. And for the entire time that we've been married, like, I am saying these are my faults and my flaws. And then you have been pointing out all of my faults and flaws again and telling the therapist, like, look at all of her faults and flaws. But I don't really hear you talking about your part to play in things. You act like you're some sort of passive victim to my idiocy or my like neglect of making you resting face or something. Like, that is not an issue to be mad about. You know what I mean? Like,
nope, I do not know what you mean. Here's me, Seth, and Matt again talking about what it felt like to listen back to that argument. And it was really interesting listening back to this argument because I was trying to tell you something like, Seth, I need you to understand that when you do this thing, it makes me feel like this. But I promise I would not say it. I would dance around this topic like every which way I possibly could because I didn't want to have to tell you what I wanted you to know. I wanted you to get it. I wanted to like hold my ideas close enough to you that you could like, oh, I get it. And she wants me to like buy her flowers, but I did not want to have to say, please buy me flowers.
Is it because that waters it down and doesn't make it as special to
you? Yeah, but so in listening back to this argument that you and I had, it is so infuriating. Infuriating?
Infuriating.
Because I never...
To who? To yourself?
Yes. To listen. So I would highly recommend that people record their arguments and dissect them. Because I thought I was being like as clear as I could possibly be. Like, oh, why doesn't Seth get this thing? And then I listened back to it and I'm like, what the hell am I trying to even say? Because I would not like just come out and say it because it felt, well, there's a couple different things. It felt too overt, too like I'm asking for exactly what I want. And I think that it's like a female thing. I think that we are trained to not say exactly what we want. And if we do say exactly what we want, we're b-y. Right.
Yeah,
so there's this
really
undergirding fear that you'll be looked at or perceived as being totally b-y. Oh my goodness. So y'all know I wanted to make that into two episodes too, right? But I ain't got time for that. So in wrapping up, there are a few things that stood out as being important to me. The first thing is that almost all of us are communicating on autopilot and accidentally, meaning that we are not really thinking about and choosing on purpose the style and way in which we communicate. And this leads to all sorts of problems. The next thing is this idea that communication is the primary way that we connect with those around us. And that reminded me of what Dr. Dan Siegel said back in episode number 5.
In fact, the process of connecting was deeply at the heart of health, whether it was enzymes connecting with different molecules or human beings connecting with each other. So,
and then this other little gem about emotional intelligence.
And basically, emotional intelligence involves the capacity for self-awareness, self-regulation, mediating the difficulties between self and other, and then also working out how you understand emotions impact the lives of other people.
But perhaps the most important thing for me in this episode is the idea that if I am really interested in growing in my marriage and in my communication with other people, I can actually assess my communication skills, evaluate them, and change them. How would I do this, you ask? Well, just like I did in the episode, I recorded myself talking or arguing with my husband. And as a side note, I want to make it perfectly clear that I never ever recorded Seth and I without asking him if it was okay first. And that's really important to note because it would break his trust if I recorded him without his knowledge. So don't do that. It ain't right. But if you and your partner are up to it, or even you and your kids are up to it, it might just help you understand the reality of your communication styles, where you excel, and where you need to grow. And lastly, I want to share the idea of creating a goal for your communication. And this might sound silly at first, but stick with me. If communication is connection, and connection is at the heart of health, then it seems like setting a goal for the way that we connect with others would be massively impactful in our lives and in the lives of those we love. But Melanie, what do you mean set a goal for communication? Well, let me tell you. You know those vision boards that are really popular right now? If you don't know what they are, they're essentially like a corkboard thing or maybe a special spot on your wall where you put up inspirational quotes and pictures that represent a thing that you want to do. And it could be anything, from your dream job to a vacation or business plan or a home design. So why not do this with our communication style? Here's how I imagine this would work. Think of the person or people in your life that have made you feel the most comforted, content, and loved through their communication style. Is it your grandma? Your best friend's dad? The lady you work with at the coffee shop? I mean, it could literally be anybody. Now, dissect what it is that they are doing that makes you feel comforted, content, and loved. Is it the tone of voice that they use? Is it their vocabulary choice? Is it the fact that they encourage you instead of discourage you? What specific things are they doing that make you feel a sense of connection? Now, vision board this for yourself. And let me tell you why I think this is important. We so often think of the things that we don't have instead of the things that we want to become, do, or create. So I would say something to myself like, oh, I'm so sarcastic, or I'm so negative, or I'm never kind, when instead I should be saying things like, I want to be more inviting. I want to learn how to be encouraging and optimistic. Do you see the difference? One comes out of a space of what I don't have, and the other comes out of a space of what I want to become.
Our show is produced by Matt Carter, edited and sound designed by Melanie Studley. Special thanks to executive producer Craig Gross and StrongerMarriages.com.
Hey everybody, it's Melanie Studley, producer and creator of the Anatomy of Marriage miniseries. I hope so much that you're enjoying the miniseries, and if you are, I have great news for you. Right now, you can actually listen to the complete Anatomy of Marriage miniseries season one in its entirety when you subscribe to Anatomy of Marriage podcast on iTunes. So that means that you don't have to wait. You can literally hear all 13 episodes of the miniseries right now. So what are you going to hear? Let me tell you. We have an episode on identity, domestic violence, mental health, communication, and what Seth and I have learned throughout the crazy process of making this miniseries. And get this, not only will you get the rest of the miniseries right now, you will also get the brand new Anatomy of Marriage audio workbook in your iTunes feed for free. And I'm so excited about this audio workbook because it's designed to help you and your spouse better understand your own thoughts and behaviors around your relationships. And I tried to make it as easy as possible by reading the whole thing to you. And if you want the downloadable PDF version of the workbook that has pictures and a diagram or two, just head over to anatomyofmarriage.com and grab it. It's also totally free.
Next week, Alyssa and I will be back at our kitchen table talking about faith, culture, and answering your questions. So, see you then.